I got approval to come down to Internet too, Ben, so I'll be there.
Oh, good. Is it spring member meeting?
April.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect. Have you gone to those before?
Yeah, I used to go to them a lot years ago, but haven't been to one for a while. Back in the late 90s.
Got
went.
It.
Yeah.
You were probably
Seattle and San Francisco and...
Yeah, before my time.
That's when Bob was running around out there like a wild man making mega conference. Right, Bob?
That's right. I didn't hear the context there.
Early Internet 2 meetings when we were doing the first and second mega conferences.
Yeah. That turned out to be a little too much.
Yeah, that was crazy times.
Well, I have a new toy.
Oh, that's good.
I have here a CompTel speakerphone thing, which is presumably going to be better than the Chat 150 before, because it has a little box here which enables you to connect to a room microphone and PA system.
Wow.
Cool. My hope is that I can then, at the Internet 2 meeting, be running collaboration tools in my laptop and connect them via this box to the room audio system. I tried that before with the Chat 150, and it was somewhat of a failure. So I ended up just holding my microphone up to the Chat 150 speaker. I think it's really neat the way that everybody's room names or whatever come up occasionally on the MCU. I'm curious, what does it say on my video when it comes up?
I don't know. We needed to switch again. I didn't notice.
Hello, this is Walt.
Hey, Walt. How are you?
Hello, is anyone else on?
Yeah, can you hear us? Can you hear us okay, Walt?
No, I'm just barely hearing you. Let me crank the volume up here a little bit. Or go ahead and speak again.
This is a test of the audio.
Okay, that level is a little bit better.
Okay.
It's better, but you could still stand more.
Am I quiet to everybody else, too?
Yeah, Bob, you sounded okay. Your level appeared to be okay.
I'm sitting kind of far away from the mic. That could be it.
Okay.
We'll try that.
Okay, that sounds pretty good.
So maybe we can go around and do roll call before we get started. West to east, maybe. Anybody in Pacific time zone? about Mountain Time Zone. How about Central Time Zone?
Yeah, this is Lance Cunningham, University of Minnesota.
Hello, Lance.
Walt Magnus.
Charles Ganshorn with Cisco in Minnesota.
I'm sorry, who was that from Cisco?
Charles Ganshorn.
Hello, Charles. Like I said, Walt Magnus in Texas A&M.
And Eastern Time Zone.
Bob Gertis from Rutgers.
Bob Dixon at Hornet.
The person on the phone, go again. I missed that.
Bob Gertis from Rutgers.
Ah, thank you. And anyone that we missed?
And, of course, here, Central Time, right, Ben?
Eastern, actually. Yeah, so here in Ann Arbor is Ben Feynman. I have Terry Saarinen graciously taking minutes. And Mike LaHaye, who has just stepped out, but he'll be back.
Okay.
So I think we can go ahead and get started.
All right, well, first of all, I need to start off by apologizing because I have not gotten as far on my homework for this week as I really thought I would have. We're currently in the process of wrapping up. I'm currently involved in four of the BTOP grants, and any of you that are working on them understand how ridiculous the documentation requirements are on those things. So anyway, that's been pretty much all-encompassing. Good news is next Friday they're pretty much done. But I've got enough to get us started anyway here on the E-164 part of the discussion. So kind of summarizing from the last meeting, I believe that what we were going to do is look at various approaches that could be used to more or less basically a global dialing system for real-time communications, including video and voice. And those plans that we are looking at is some type of implementation of E.164. Kind of an offshoot of it, again, would be ENUM. And then we were going to look at possibility of possibly looking at something like IMS, and then the GDS that's already out there, the global dialing system that was...
Okay, and then the IMS was a... mistake. It was IME, not IMS, that Cisco was proposing.
Okay. Okay. That's a real good point because is this Charles that was talking then?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Great. I still think IMS would be a reasonable way of looking at it as well, but I can provide some of the background information or get maybe somebody from the IMS forum to go ahead and talk to us about IMS, but IME is. You want to kind of maybe give us? Can you give us a real quick overview of what that is?
It's another way to exploit E-164 addressing, despite the fact that there's no authoritative lookup on the internet, and it exploits calls made across the current PSTN to create a common secret, shared secret between two organizations. Based on a call between valid DID numbers so that routing information across an IP network established via a peer-to-peer mechanism can be believed because you can validate that somebody's claim to have a certain E-164 address is validated by the fact that they know the shared secret of a call that actually happened across the PSTN with those numbers. And now once you've got the IP route, you can do whatever media you care to negotiate across that connection.
Okay, but it's so then one of the presumptions then is that you still have a valid E-164 number behind it, and then the second one is that basically it has to. So you're using in essence since you're validating it across a dial plan, and so you're using in essence the kind of the SS7 infrastructure to say, yes, it can be connected. And once it's connected, then you discover a valid IP route from there.
Right, since there's no direct lookup database for me to claim validity of an EO64 address, this is another way of showing the validity of my claim to have a certain EO64 address.
Okay. Well, that might put a real interesting twist to what I was going to be talking about today with the E-164 part of it. And really, E-164 by itself, you know, there's, well, first of all, let me kind of then, so we're looking at E-164, ENUM, IMS, GDS, IME, and then I think it was also brought it up that in essence kind of a gatekeeper federation type system may end up working as well. Is that one of the ideas that was brought up late in the last call?
Yes.
Or did I kind of dream that one up?
No, I think that's right.
Okay, good. Okay. So looks to me like we have six options to possibly recommend, and somehow we got to come to a consensus as to what we think really the best approach would be. So again, what we're going to do here is over the next 6-7 meetings, then bring in some subject matter experts on each of those six areas. And then, Charles, as we go forward, then would you be the person that would want to present on the IME part of it?
Sure.
Okay. And if you want to bring in, you know, somebody else from Cisco as well, that's perfectly acceptable. I mean, that sounds real, real good. Okay. All right. So today's meeting may be somewhat brief in that, again, I don't really have anywhere close to all of the answers, but I think I've got basically enough to really, really get us started here. E-164 is it's part of the ITU standard, so it's a standard that basically is put forward. And I'm going to assume that most everybody knows what the ITU is. Anyone not familiar with the ITU? Okay, good. All right, so E-164 is an ITU standard that in essence puts together the dialing process that the telephone companies have been using for the last century plus. The last version of the ITU recommendation came out in 2004, so it's a fairly stable document. Hasn't been modified a whole bunch. But in essence, it recommends across the board that all of the dial sequences be 15 digits long. And of the 15 digits, in essence, what you have is a country code is the first set of digits. And then you will have what they're referring to as a location-specific code. And that, in our case, is basically the central office code. And then you will have the subscriber code for the last part of it. So subscriber code, for example, calling me, country code is 1, area code is 979-409 is the or 690 is the office code, and then 0747 is the subscriber code. So you've got the series of digits that, again, maximum of 15. Not everybody uses 15. It says within each area, you're allowed to basically customize it, just like we do in PBXs, whether you do 3-digit dialing, 4-digit dialing, 5-digit dialing, whatever you happen to do, you can abbreviate it within your country if it's appropriate. There are also then 4 types of codes that are defined, or 4 types of number sequences that are defined within E-164. The first one is referred to as the geographic codes. And the geographic codes, for the most part, are the ones we're most familiar with. It's the country code, area code, office code, subscriber. The second one, too, is what's referred to as a global service code. And the global service code gives you the ability to define a service and then have subnumbering within that service. And the global service code was the process that I was trying to see if we could possibly end up defining a global service, become the authority over that global service, and once we do that, then go ahead and utilize that series of numbers. Within, just like you have with Internet addresses, you got ARIN administering the Internet addresses for the United States. You have you have the NANPA, the North American Numbering Plan Administrator, administering the numbers within the United States. The NANPN administrator, it's done under a series of contracts. It's basically done under the auspices and direction and guidance of the FCC for North America. But they also, just like Aaron, they actually end up contracting that out to organizations. The company that's had the organization for the last three or four contracts has been a company called called Neustar. And is anyone familiar with Neustar?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I got a yes and a no, so let me kind of back up a little bit on that one. Neustar is a corporation that was started by the it's owned by the telephone company. So just like Internet 2 is a group that's owned by the various university member universities, Neustar is a corporation that's owned by the Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, Singular, all of the telephone companies. Their major job out there is being responsible for the local number portability database. That's one of the biggest things that they do. So when you port a number from one company to another company, you want to be able to make sure that you can easily still dial that number even though it's owned by a different company. So they manage and administer a database behind the systems that let you do what they call LNP DIPs or local number portability DIPs to find out who the actual owner of that subscriber is at that time. In addition to doing that, they also are the dial plan administrators for the United States. I reached out to one of the folks that I've worked with for a number of years in Neustar, Brian Rosen, this morning. In fact, he emailed me back here just a little bit earlier. He was basically saying that one of his contacts within the company would probably be, her name is Karen Mulberry, would probably be the best person for us to contact to try to get some answers. So what I was going to do before the next meeting is contact Karen, but also then see if Karen would possibly be available to actually address this group here at the next subsequent meeting. That would be one approach. That would be for us to go together and actually get, in essence, what would almost be equivalent to our own country code, and then, in essence, we have the ability to administer that. Now, that may have some issues. It probably would have some issues with dialing from, again, this is going to be voice and video services. It would probably have issues dialing off of our PBXs, unless we also provided routes for the various PBXs and things like that to that service code. I'm not really sure what all is involved there, so that would end up taking a little bit of work. The other viable option within E-164 is just use blocks of telephone numbers that we currently have assigned to our campuses already and just use them for video services only, and then to redirect those numbers from our local campuses to a non-voice type proxy. That may or may not be viable, and that's going to probably have some significant issues as well. But, that would be another way that you could do that. But the other services, it sounds a lot, that we're looking at, things like IME and things like IMS, and even ENUM, all three of those are ways of trying to figure out how to disperse the numbers. But the bottom line is they still... the numbers they're still dispersing are basically E-164 numbers. So E-164 is kind of at the core of the whole shoot and match. No matter which way you go, unless you're either looking at GDF or Gatekeeper Federation, neither GDF nor Gatekeeper Federation would have to have E-164 numbers behind them. Questions, comments, concerns, confusion?
In the last week or so,
contacted the guy that runs the SIP inter-exchange service with Neustar, a guy named Tim Cody, and approached him about, well, what would be the possibility of I2 trying to get involved with the inter-exchange and exchange routes with existing providers on an IP basis to get calls through. And, you know, he was all over that. The issue was in the exchange service they run, you have to get mutual agreements with whomever to see who's going to let you actually look at their information and pass calls back and forth to you.
Right.
And that was probably the sticking point. I mean, he'd be all for having us being able to connect him with the carriers. The problem is, would the carriers play ball? And they have in the past not been so interested in that. They're willing to some extent pass traffic between each other, but not necessarily with what they consider, you know, non-carrier enterprises. I'm not sure that they would view Internet 2 as a peer in that respect.
Well, and who was that that was just talking, by the way?
This is Charles from Cisco again.
Hey, Charles, okay. And even beyond the SIP interexchange, though, we did another project earlier with an organization called ARPANET that actually what they do is similar to SIP interexchange, except for basically what they do is they provide a service that in essence you subscribe to, and then when you subscribe to it, you end up going into their SIP registrar, and when you do that, in essence, really what happens is you specify, you know, do you want your numbers advertised to the entire global community? Do you only want them advertised to Internet 2, or do you want them to go out to, you know, even within, for example, only within your own university system? So other carriers that subscribe to that service, if they are doing global advertisements and you're doing global advertisements, you would see them as well. The drawback to their scenario is, in essence, what you end up paying about half a cent a call to set up a call to basically do a dip into their database. But again, it's on a per call basis; it's not on a per minute basis. So that is kind of an advantage. But again, both of those are really primarily designed around SIP-based calls. The thing we've got to remember here, though, is that in essence, whatever we do is going to have to support the H.323 world as well, because we still have a very, very significant population of 323. And on telepresence, when Cisco is doing telepresence, do you know offhand, Charles, is that currently SIP-based signaling, or is that 323-based signaling?
It's SIP-based, but there are there's something that we put out there now, telepresence. It's TIP, Telepresence Interworking Protocol, or something like that, TIP or TRIP, I forget the acronym, which is, it's all SIP signaling, and we do all standard codecs. The thing that's different about the implementation than any other implementation is multiplexing. We multiplex the multiple audio and video streams onto single media transports as opposed to an individual media transport per individual audio and video stream, and its TIP is basically the logic of that multiplexing, so that you can so you can negotiate a common media. The thing that would break trying to talk SIP directly between a telepresence endpoint and a not telepresence endpoint right now is they wouldn't have any media in common. The neither side would understand the other's media, and that's one of the things that we're making available, is that people can, you know, add this TIP to their endpoint, and effectively what it does is lets you understand the media multiplexing that we do.
And there's nothing within the SDPs currently within SIP that would let you do that multiplexing type process?
Well, I could send you the SDP, but the what I'm representing in the SDP you wouldn't understand, because it's not just a plain video audio codec. It's a multiplexed. It's like MPEG transport as opposed to single program transport.
Got it. Okay, I see. Okay.
But yeah, it's SIP. And now the thing about 323, too, is that in a world of calls negotiated by call control, the protocol of the originating endpoint doesn't necessarily have to relate to the protocol of the trunking protocol. So you could use SIP trunks and support 323 endpoints.
you do SIP trunks and do 323 endpoints.
Yeah, yeah, because like that's what we do in our call control designs is call manager talks, you know, whatever to the endpoint. It's, you know, our own skinny protocol. It's 323. It's SIP to the endpoint, but the trunk protocol between call managers might be, you know, SIP. It might be 323.
Got it.
Regardless of what the endpoint protocol is and the trunk, there's not necessarily a relationship between the trunk and the endpoint protocol.
Okay. Well, yeah, and in essence, really what you're doing basically is you're putting a protocol mediation device in the middle to really...
Right.
Got it.
And save for telepresence, whether it's skinny or SIP or 323, while the signaling of how you set the media streams up might be different, once you get media set up, pretty much everybody packages their media the same way with the same codecs. It's all, you know, H.263 over RTP when all is said and done at the end of the day, for example. That's why the endpoints of different protocols can talk media directly to one another, because how I signal the media stream might be different, but the way I encapsulate it on the network and the codec in which I wrap it is the same.
Okay.
So does that imply, you guys, that we could have some sort of a multi-protocol signaling box in the middle of an architecture that allowed interoperable data streams to be set up, or media streams?
Yeah. That's how, like I said, that's how our designs work. Is the endpoints can be whatever protocol they like, and you trunk between the different call control platforms with, you know, dealer's choice of protocol. Depends upon what, you know, what you need to talk to the other side.
So I understand that's what Cisco's doing, but is that viable for interoperability across multiple vendor products?
That's the only way you can do interoperability across multiple products, because, you know, in essence, if not everyone... You know, if we could go to something like straight IMS, if everyone in the world said, starting tomorrow, I'm going to do nothing but SIP, and that's the way it's going to be, that's not going to happen. So until the day that we are all intercommunicating and on one platform, on one signaling protocol, there's going to have to be something in the middle that's going to do the mediation between the various systems.
Right, but I expected that to be a media gateway as well, and what I'm hearing now is that maybe it doesn't have to be a media gateway.
No, it's
a
signaling gateway. Yeah, right. It's the media goes direct.
Yeah, if it can, yeah. I mean, if both sides also have the ability, if both sides have the ability to support the same codecs, which isn't always necessarily the case either. But I mean, if I can go ahead and send the media straight through, you want to do that, because transcoding, by its very definition and nature, is inherently bad. Every time you re-encode information, you have degradation.
Not to mention delay.
Yeah.
And in the voice world, it's really, really common to, behind the scenes, you know, with nobody's knowledge of it in the call, you're making a point, what you think is a point-to-point call, but unbeknownst to you, you ended up negotiating incompatible codecs, and the call control just inserts a media termination point into the call and does transcoding for you automatically. And that's something that's coming to video, but not something that's actually really realized in video right now. That same automagic logic of, oh, okay, I'm trying to hook up these calls, and the two endpoints didn't offer a intersecting set of codecs. And so I engage a transcoder. That doesn't happen in general now. Now the only way it works is there's some intersection between the media types that the different endpoints offered, and they managed to find a common media.
I'm assuming most people use their MCUs for that right now, because they'll transcode between protocols and codecs.
Well, that's one way you can get things working between people, but then that precludes a point-to-point call. Like for example, that's one of the downsides of our current solution for telepresence interoperability is there's this cascaded there's a multi-point switch that we use natively in telepresence, and there's an MCU that's a standards-based MCU, and they cascade the two of them together, and everybody who's not telepresence goes to the MCU, and everybody who is telepresence goes to the multi-point switch, and then the cascade link links the two of them together. And so there's no such thing as a point-to-point call between the telepresence endpoint and the not telepresence endpoint. And when the transcoding becomes available, and this is something we've got coming out later this year for the telepresence, is I'll be able to make a point-to-point call, and you just engage this transcoder so that despite the fact that the other guy doesn't know what my telepresence media looks like, he's able to make a point-to-point call with me because we're going to dynamically insert this transcoder in between so that you can have a compatible media on either side and still have a point-to-point call without having to meet somebody at an MCU.
The logic in the core of the network could use the MCU as that device, and then they would never know they connected to an MCU, as opposed to having an outboard of the MCU itself.
Right. That's something that you know we're aiming towards, but as far as I know, doesn't happen anywhere right now.
No. That's one of the areas we want to look at in terms of being able to have it. Like you said, automatically recognize that you're connecting to H323 and then engage a third party, whether that's an MCU or a specialized...
Well actually, that's not the problematic case. SIP to 323 isn't necessarily a problem. The fact that my signaling protocol was different doesn't necessarily mean I need to engage a transcoder, because I can offer common media across SIP to 323. That happens already today. I mean, because you're going to offer 263. I'm going to offer 263. I'm going to offer 263. You're going to offer G729. I'm going to offer G729, and we can talk directly as long as somebody can interwork the signaling. Where you would engage the transcoder is you offered only 263, and I offered only 264, and now we need a transcoder.
Yeah, if you look at the
on my HB23 system too, I'll offer H239 as a media sharing channel, and in SIP it's binary floor control protocol, so those would have to be converted too.
Yeah, that probably would need maybe not.
Because
ultimately that's just another video stream. So as long as the content channels being offered on a common codec, you may or may not need transcoding.
And overall, basically, the signaling protocol conversion is relatively easy. It's the media conversion that really starts to suck up a lot of energy and a lot more money.
Well, and it degrades the experience, because anytime, like you say, you degrade the actual media and you insert extra delay.
You know, basically, if you look at every long-distance call that's made by every major carrier on the network now, as soon as they hit the edge of the network, they go through a Sonus gateway, and the Sonus gateway basically converts the SS7 signaling to SIP signaling and converts... But it doesn't do anything with the media. It just passes the media straight through. It just assigns a media channel on one of their TDM trunks. So, basically, if you're making a long-distance call, that protocol conversion is probably happening twice in every single call if you're calling from PSTN to PSTN. So Charles, what would you think? I mean, one of the problems of basically doing getting a little bit ahead of myself, but if you look at the IME portion of it, one of the things that I thought was going to throw a stumbling block into that is if we go right straight to the NANPA and try to get a global code for our services, those numbers probably are not going to ever go through the SS7 network. So if they're never really validated by the telco, would we still be able to? I mean, how would we basically do the validation that would be needed for IME?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. That's I mean, that would be a disjoint approach to being part of E-164, right? I mean, the only way it would end up working is if then you could, once you're granted this other country code, if they would in fact peer with you in something like the Neustar SIP exchange.
Okay. And actually, Karen Mulberry did just send me a document, too, that basically explains how you would get one of the global numbers. And she also did indicate that when you have a global number, you can map it to, you can get an interconnect arrangement with one of the telephone companies, and then they will then map that series of numbers for you. So you could actually, it looks like you could get validation through one of the telcos as long as they're willing to do that. I'll send this document out. This is actually an extension of the IT standards, but it's E-164.1. And it's called the Criteria and Procedures for the Reservation Assignment and Reclamation of E-164 Country Codes and Associated Identity Codes. It's only about a 20-some page document, so I'll go through it and then see if I can figure out if it makes any sense to try that approach. But I'll also, like I said, see if Karen would possibly be available to kind of talk us through some of the pros and cons of reserving our own numbers versus using the numbers that currently are designated to our campus, which is, again, one of the nice things about doing a global number would possibly be to do this about the same type of thing that we did in GDS, and that would be to have one central box, and it could keep track of where all the numbers are instead of having each of us have to map those numbers across everybody's individual switches and routers. I take it, though, Charles, that the IME platform will do that as well, too. You guys could provide a central repository of nodes that are set up across the entire network.
It forms a big peer-to-peer network. There's a certificate authority at GoDaddy that validates that you're a valid member of the peer-to-peer network, and then the database of who's got what DIDs are in a distributed hash table run by the peer-to-peer network.
Okay.
So this is something, Charles, just to make sure I understand, that's deployed by, you know, multiple corporations, for example, for their B2B activities. But in theory, would scale to, you know, this community's needs.
Yeah, it's intended to be able to, we don't know of a limit on it yet. I mean, obviously, this is something that's just getting going. So if there is a limit out there, we don't know what it is yet. But yeah, it's intended to be able to scale to a global scope.
Okay, so I didn't ask my question real well. Is this something that Cisco is rooting, and then you're hanging branches off of it so that you can provide full reachability, or is it something that General Motors would deploy to provide IP reachability between their business partners on their network?
It we're rooting it in as much as, you know, the seed member of the peer-to-peer network is a Cisco node out on the internet, and then there's also the GoDaddy certificate, and yeah, everybody that wants to participate, a GM or whomever, would get an IME server that would get a certificate, become part of the peer-to-peer network, and then of course, anybody that runs one of these servers in the peer-to-peer network can also control how much or how little information they want to put into the peer-to-peer network, and also to whom they want to have visibility. So they could selectively pick to have rich media calls across the internet between some people and not others.
Okay, so in this peer-to-peer network, you know, if one of these were in the Internet 2 network, our routes, for example, could be shared with Cisco.
Could, if you allowed them to. You could control whether they were or not.
Got it. Thank you. Just wanted to make sure I understood the scope of this.
Mm-hmm. There is actually, so we've got IME implemented, you know, and we've got a few people participating outside of Cisco, and there is a research network, AARNet, and at least some part of the University of Wisconsin that's participating.
And are they doing, are they primarily doing this currently strictly for voice, strictly for video, or for both?
Well, the whole point of it is to be able to do a rich media call.
Okay.
I mean, I can already do voice calls across the PS10, so that's not real interesting. And as far as toll bypass goes and call reduction, well, it's really not too compelling for that either. The compelling part of this is, you know, media, you know, video presence, that sort of thing.
Okay. So research channel, RNet, and part of you, part of
UW Wisconsin. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to try to. I had just found that out a few minutes before the call, and I'm going to dig into that a bit more. The guys that run Cisco eats their own dog food to some extent, but there are there's kind of a bleeding edge subsystem inside of Cisco where all the really, really new toys, you can opt in to be part of that. The thing that runs the global voice network inside of Cisco tends to be back from the edge a bit. And there's this environment we run that's, you know, if you can opt in to be on the very bleeding edge, and they're starting to use the IME technology and then participating in that network with some external entities so they can get a feel for how it's working or not.
Okay, very good. That sounds promising. So, I mean, actually for the meeting 2 weeks from now, then let me see if I can go ahead and get, I'll see if I can get Karen to opt in to do that and talk to us for a while as well. But what we might want to do then is if maybe, Charles, would you be ready to go ahead and also do some talking at the same meeting then on kind of an additional dig on IME?
Sure, there's not a whole lot more to say, so what I'll, you know, I mean, I've given you the broad strokes of how it works. I'll try to get more real-world data from the guys running the quote-unquote new network that's using IME in production.
Okay.
And see what they can tell me that's, you know, more real-world, more, you know, what they've learned so far in having it up and running for a while.
Okay. Yeah. And also, anything you can get us on the you said it was the TIP protocol or the probably it's TIP.
Yeah, I think it's TIP. It's Telepresence Interoperability Protocol.
Okay.
And I can get more information on that. And that's just something someone would build into a product. And like I say, largely what it is just so that you understand how to multiplex and demultiplex the video and audio streams that we use in Telepresence.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't think they would use TRIP. That one's already been used. That's already a protocol.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we're running out of acronyms.
Yeah, and nobody deployed TRIP anyway, right? So we can probably start to reuse that one.
Exactly.
All right, well, that sounds pretty good. Ben, did you is there any other questions at all for today's meeting? Or, Ben, did you have anything else that we need to do at this time?
I think we're pretty good. So the plan is to have the next meeting at the same time slot 2 weeks from now. And,
do we need to have Adobe Connect or anything ready to go for slide sharing?
Yeah, if we think it's useful, I can set up a slide sharing session. We think we might want to have that.
I would imagine that at least one or two of the presenters will probably request that, yeah, so that would definitely be beneficial.
Okay, so I'll have that set up for the next meeting in 2 weeks.
Okay. So does the presenter need to get slides to you in advance, or do we need to, if whoever the presenter is, do we need to kind of get them up to speed on how to, if they're going to host it from their side, on how to be the presenter?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty straightforward, but I should probably spend 5 minutes with them before the call just to get everything ready to go.
Yeah, make sure that they don't have anything on their laptop that precludes it from being able to do that.
Yep.
Like an overly protective sysadmin that doesn't let you load anything, right?
Exactly.
Okay. All right, that sounds good. Lance, Bob, you guys have anything else?
Nothing to add.
Okay. All right, it sounds like, once again, we're a little bit further along and still probably have a lot more questions than we have answers. So, Charles, are you going to be going to be attending this meeting regularly then as well?
Yeah, I put it on my schedule, and I'm trying to avoid conflicts on top of it.
Perfect. Okay, sounds good. All right, we greatly appreciate it, and I guess we'll talk to everyone in 2 weeks then.
Okay, thanks, Walt. Thanks, right, everybody.
Thanks. Okay.
Bye.
Right, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.